There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Madel, and I'm your host. On today's program, my pal John Anderson's in the studio here. We're going to catch up on what's going on with unlicensed and pirate radio this year, what the FCC's been up to, and maybe touch on some other topics about radio and broadcast and that sort of thing. It's always a fun time when John is here, so you want to stay tuned. Well, John, thanks for coming down here again tonight.
Thanks for having me.
It seems like many of the times when you come down here, it's just as Champaign-Urbana has suffered an ice storm or a snowstorm of sorts.
Although it's great.
We made out pretty well compared to the rest of Illinois.
Yes, we did.
But the ice is out there. But you didn't fall.
I shuffled my booty through downtown Champaign,
taking
notes of the businesses who do not clean off their sidewalks. But otherwise,
persistent problem here,
right,
in the oasis of central Illinois.
There's a different way of walking in the winter. It involves a lot of butt clenching.
Well, you know, and which has its own rewards at the end with a tighter booty.
That's right.
So you'll be ready for spring break
and my Speedo wearing
and your Speedo wearing action. So now that I have to cleanse that thought from my mind, let's talk about some pirate radio.
Sure.
You've been keeping up with the FCC's enforcement actions this year on radio pirates.
Yes.
So where are we at?
Right now, there have been 235 enforcement actions against pirate radio stations over the course of the entire year, and that covers something like, close to 20 states, extending all the way coast to coast from California all the way to Massachusetts. If you go northwest, you've got Oregon. If you go to the southeast, you've got Florida. Up here in the Midwest, the most active states have been South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
So what FCC office hits those Midwestern states?
There's three, actually, that can potentially hit Midwestern states. One is based just outside of Chicago near O'Hare Airport.
And has that one been active?
No, actually, that one has not really done much of anything all year. Usually, they try to they bust a couple people in Northwest Indiana, a couple people in Illinois, but so far this year, it's been pretty much quiet. There's an office in Farmington, Michigan, which I guess is just outside of Detroit. And then there's actually two more. One is what's called a resident agent office based out of St. Paul, Minnesota. There's only one FCC agent working out of there right now, and I think he's busy doing stuff other than busting pirates. And then you have an office near St. Louis, and those are the three regional offices. The main of those three is the office in Chicago. It's called the Regional District Headquarters Office. Mm-hmm. And then the other ones are smaller offices.
You'd think that it would be the main office there in Chicago that would be having all the – you know, would be doing the most.
Right.
And so it's interesting to hear that they're doing the least.
You know, historically speaking, having looked at these statistics for the last 10 years now, the Chicago office has been, of the larger offices, the one that's been least active on the pirate front. The most active offices tend to be the ones on the coasts. You have the office in just outside of Los Angeles. You have one just outside of San Francisco. There's one in Boston and another one in New York City that tend to be pretty active. And those have been areas of concentrated pirate activity for a long time. And even though the FCC has nominally upgraded its enforcement actions over the last year or so, meaning that they're doing a lot more administrative enforcement than they have in the past, there's still a lot of pirates to bust. Nothing is really acting as a deterrent to slow them down.
So the fact that there's fewer enforcement actions coming out of the Chicago office, you think, is probably partially a factor of fewer complaints, less concentrated activity, and then maybe is it also due to different priorities within the local office or different pressures, perhaps?
Yes.
Maybe there's more pressure to go after the pirates on some of the coasts.
Right. And the funny thing is even though I can't say this for sure, just looking at like the dates of the correspondence that FCC field agents issue to pirates across the country, there appears to be specific days of the year and specific months even of the year where pirates tend to get their bust on.
There's like an agenda.
Right.
Almost.
Right. It's like the FCC enforcement office, offices have to do a lot of different things. They have to go out and monitor cable systems to make sure they're not leaking RF energy onto air traffic control frequencies. They have to go around and inspect radio stations to make sure things like their antennas are properly lighted and painted. They have to go around and inspect public files. They have to investigate phone slamming and cramming complaints. They have just this wide range of laws that they have to enforce, and pirates in relative terms are not that big of a deal. So I think what the FCC has been doing, especially this year, is they go out basically and they have pirate hunting days. Like, for example, in October, they went out and across the country, in fact, in some places in California, some places in New York, they went out on the same day. It was like October 18th, and they went out and found pirates that they had complaints about.
So they went
about.
All over like Brooklyn and
right.
Queens.
They basically developed up, and in New Jersey, they developed up a list of complaints that they'd gotten over the last few months, and then they went out and they tracked these pirates down. They confirmed where their addresses were, and then a week later, they sent them all letters. And the letters all say, on the same date, we, you know, actually found your radio station and everything. So I think that in order to most effectively use the field time that agents have, they're consolidating a lot of their field enforcement onto specific days or into specific months, and then taking care of them in batch form and then issuing their warning letters and proceeding from there.
Now, for organized pirates, for people who, because, you know, there seems to be that some of the people I read through the enforcement action database occasionally, and some of the people who get busted running unlicensed stations seem to be of the clueless variety.
Yes.
Meaning that they were sort of vaguely aware that what they were doing probably wasn't permitted, but weren't really thinking of it as an act which was some sort of like they were doing anything illegal, and that they're simply just putting their own station on. Yeah, this wasn't right. An act of resistance against the state. It was just putting on a station, and therefore didn't think about it. But then there's certainly a class of pirates who are doing this much more as resistance, mm-hmm. right? As a sort of act that they know they're doing something which the state doesn't permit, and might, you know, it seems like that class of pirates could really use this data to their best advantage to
right.
really start to figure out what are the more likely windows. It's, you know, just the same way that truckers call each other to inform each other where the speed traps are
right.
on the interstates.
Right, smoky alerts.
Realize that you can't enforce speeding on all the interstates at all points at all times. This would seem to be a similar situation.
Sure. And there's also a third class of pirates, which has kind of developed, especially as low-power FM was taking off, like in 99, 2000 and afterwards. And those are the pirates that really don't give a damn one way or the other
right.
about whether the act that they're doing is illegal or not, because they've weighed the relative risk of putting a station on the air versus either A, how much publicity they can get by running a station before the FCC comes and gets them, or B, how much money they can make. This is something that we really haven't seen in the United States, is the commercial pirate variety. And there are more commercially operated pirates occurring now than I think there have been ever.
Really?
In
so
US
so
history.
Like the guys who were up in the Quad Cities.
Right.
Over in Bettendorf,
right.
Iowa.
There was a guy, for example, in Newark, New Jersey, by the name of Casey Rankine, who actually ran a record label called like G Unit Records or something. It was a hip hop label. And he ran a station called Roadblock Radio out of the back of a nightclub. And so the radio station was effectively a promotional tool for the nightclub to get people to come in. And then when the FCC came and visited, he found out about it and he moved it to his offices of G City Records is what it's called in Newark, New Jersey. And he was using it as a promotional tool to promote the artists that he had on his record label. This is something that's interesting because there have been commercial pirates in the past, don't get me wrong, but for the most part, they've been very localized. Like, for example, in the state of Florida,
right, right.
where you typically have underserved communities like Haitians that cannot get any sort of airtime on a commercial licensed station, they will put up stations and run them and promote their own nightclubs, promote their own record labels and things like that. Now we're starting to see that type of activity expanding. You mentioned the folks in Iowa. There's also been folks in New Jersey. There's been a couple of folks out in California. And that's really interesting because it involves a different level of risk analysis. It's not so much about learning the laws and how you're breaking them and what your penalties are. It's what's the chances of actually getting caught? And if I get caught, what's that going to mean as far as penalties in regards to how much money that I can make in the interim? And the interesting thing about the FCC's enforcement actions this year is that they have been a little bit more tenacious as far as going through the first steps of the process, actually doing performing the station visit, trying to make contact with the operators, and then sending them a warning letter. In the past, it used to be that the FCC would go out and they would visit a pirate station, and it could be anywhere from 1 to 6 months before the follow-up letter that actually officially notifies the station, we have you, you're on our radar, if you don't stop, you're going to be fined or thrown in jail. That used to take 1 to 6 months just to get to that step. Now the FCC is actually turning these letters around in a week. So they're being a little bit more tenacious. But once they get to that warning letter stage, there doesn't seem to be any increase in tenaciousness beyond that. For example, this guy Casey Rankine in Newark, New Jersey, was just issued a notice of apparent liability, which is a pre-fine. It means that the FCC is going to fine you $10,000 unless you give them a good reason not to. It's usually the third step in the process. Visit, warning letter, fine warning, actual fine. Four-step process. Well, he was first picked up on the station's radar on October 12th of 2005. They went and visited this guy like a half dozen times. Over the course of November, December, December again, January, February,
now,
March,
April. Did they ever actually talk to him, or did they just see his
yeah,
transmitter?
Yeah, they actually found where his antenna was at two separate locations. And then in May, they ended up looking up some phone records and determining that the phone number that was being given out over the air happened to be the same phone number as the G-City Records store.
Oh, really? So they actually revealed that they went to that level of investigative capacity.
Right. They actually go to phone companies and get the information so that they can basically cross-reference to make sure that they've got one more piece of evidence to say that this is an unlicensed operation. And one time they showed up at G-City Records, and there was a guy backing out of his car out of a driveway, and it happened to be him. And he basically, you know, showed him his ID and then said, I gotta leave. So they nominally made contact with him, but it took, you know, 8 months before the FCC actually got around to threatening the guy with a monetary penalty, and there's still one more step to go before they actually issue a forfeiture against
which they have to attempt to collect from the courts.
Right, and if most of these people obviously don't pay, and the FCC in all of its cases, like once it issues its forfeiture letter, it basically starts a 5-year clock, and a pirate radio unlicensed operation violation is a 5-year-long violation. So the statute of limitations runs out after 5 years. And the FCC historically has not been very good at collecting fines before the violations actually expire. The last report that the FCC's inspector general did was way back in 1999. But back then, they said that the FCC collects on approximately 1/4 of all of the forfeitures that it actually assesses.
And that's all forfeitures.
That's
not
all
just,
forfeitures, not just
pirates.
That's
licensed stations, cable companies on that
everybody,
line.
Everybody. And so unless the FCC either gets some help from U.S. Attorney General's offices, which it has not historically seen any help from to any significant regard, it's still mostly a paper tiger. It is still mostly an administrative exercise that really does not have any deterrent effect on keeping pirates off the air. And one of the other things that I like to note, because there's actually been some news coverage about enforcement actions in the past couple months or so.
Why don't you hold that for a second, if you can? I just want to tell everyone that they're listening to Media Geek here.
Yes.
My guest is John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, also the producer behind Media Minutes, a weekly 5-minute newscast at the intersection of media and democracy.
We hunt the jaywalkers.
Produced for Free Press. But you do want to check out DIYmedia.net for the latest in news about unlicensed radio and various spectrum issues, as well as frequently updated tons of MP3 good stuff in the form of truthful translations, collage art. That's DIYmedia.net. Of course, Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. So you're saying, John, there's been a lot of press coverage this year about unlicensed radio and enforcement action against it.
Right, because the numbers, if you look at the actual numbers of enforcement actions that have taken place over the last year, I mean, it's more than effectively doubled from 2005. It seems like it's just the FCC is going gangbusters. They've opened this great war on pirate radio. Let's see here. In 2005. 2006, so far it's been 235. In 2005, it was 153. So not quite double, but we're getting there. And most of that is administrative. So like when reporters have talked to me about what does this mean, there's two things you can say. Yes, the FCC is paying some sort of nominal closer attention to pirates, and they're issuing a lot more paperwork to show that they're actually caring that there's pirates out there. But the one thing you have to remember also is that there wouldn't be so much enforcement action if there weren't so many pirates. And the fact that we've seen an increase in enforcement action simply, to my mind, means that there are a heck of a lot more pirates out there to bust. And that, in my mind, is a good thing. So.
Well, so let's... You know, the way I've generally covered unlicensed radio here on Media Geek, and I think the way that you've kind of looked at it as well, has been really from the standpoint of civil disobedience, right? I mean, in a lot of ways, the father of the micro radio movement in the U.S. is always identified as Mbana Kantako out of Springfield, Illinois, who started Human Rights Radio, which started as the Tenants' Rights Association Radio, as a way to communicate to his community about their rights and the way that they were being oppressed by the Springfield Housing Authority, the local police, and different local officials. And that's kind of the way we've always covered it. And certainly the stations that I've highlighted have been the stations who are taking that tact, well, whether it's San Francisco Liberation Radio or Freak Radio Santa Cruz or Free Radio Brattleboro. And so now we have a rise of pirate radio, which starts to look a lot more like what you saw in the UK prior to the approval of commercial radio there, the offshore pirates, or you saw in Netherlands before the approval of commercial radio there, that are people who are creating stations that are much more commercial-like in nature, or for the purpose or for commercial purposes. How does that sort of change the playing field for people who are... You know, for the sort of folks who are in more of the civil disobedience mold.
Well, for the folks in Florida specifically, where there tends to be a huge influx of commercial pirates, it pisses them off greatly,
and it really makes their lives miserable because Florida has the state felony statute against pirate radio.
Yeah, and in the last 2 months, the state authorities there have arrested three pirate station operators. So they're actually building up a backlog of cases that will eventually make their way into the state courts, where the law can actually be formally challenged. There's some questions as to whether the state actually has any authority to enforce a federal licensing law. A good pirate friend of mine, who is one of the only people to actually, the only person to actually serve federal prison time for doing unlicensed broadcasting, he came out of Florida, said in effect, he's also a very smart legal eagle, said in effect, it would kind of be like if you wanted to drive in the state of Florida, you have to get a license from Alaska in order to do it.
Right.
He actually called the Secretary of State's office and said, could I get a license to broadcast since you're enforcing this anti-pirate law? Can I get a license? And they were like, what are you talking about? And he frustrated them for about 10 minutes before they hung up on him. But that is a possible avenue of challenging the state law. So there's some questions of the validity of Florida's anti-pirate law. And New Jersey has a similar law which hasn't had any arrests or any cases developed in that. Anyway, getting back to your original question, what does this do? What does this mean when there are more commercial pirates? Well, I don't really know. I mean, there's a couple of ways you can look at it. The first one is that the act of broadcasting is sufficiently technically challenging enough that those who typically engage in it are aware of the risks that they are running. So even though they may not have a political motivation for putting a station on the air without a license, they still do some sort of risk assessment to determine whether or not the law is worth breaking. It may not be in the forefront of their minds when they're doing it, but it is still at least nominally a political decision that they have to make. They don't wear it on their sleeves, but that's okay. In a larger sense, it really doesn't mean much of anything different from what you know, the typically more politically motivated pirates would say. For example, a lot of politically motivated pirates, I think, would agree with commercially motivated pirates in saying that there is a market failure in commercial radio, that commercial radio does not serve entire communities, and it's been so heavily formatted to target specific demographics that a lot of the populace is being left behind. And where you see that manifest itself the greatest is in places where populations are growing that have no access to the airwaves. And those typically tend to be, you know, immigrant populations and things like that. That's why we've seen what we've seen in Florida. That's why we see what we're seeing in like California, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, for example, is a big Hispanic pirate town, because there aren't a lot of Hispanically owned or Hispanically programmed stations out there for people to get their messages out. And so they're looking at it from a lot of ways, in a similar mindset, but they've just got their priorities a little bit different. One of the things that is negative about this is that because they have a commercial impetus, they want to reach the widest possible audience geographically, and that means that these pirates tend to run huge amounts of power. And that increases the chance of interfering with other stations, right, and causing complaints, and that ultimately can give pirates in general a bad name. You know, because one of the things that I think a lot of politically motivated pirates talk about is that they're stewards of the airwaves. They're just borrowing something that they already own. But they go out of their way to make sure that they don't screw up any other person that's using the airwaves. I'm not quite sure if commercial pirates think in the same mindset. And that may just possibly be because their priorities and why they're putting stations on the air are different. But it is a danger. And as we've seen, for example, in the state of Florida, the local media, commercial media, have picked up on that angle of things and are hyping the apparent danger that pirate radio stations can cause to things like air traffic control frequencies and things like that. However, of all of the, I think there's been like 8 or 9 pirate radio enforcement cases against commercial pirates in Florida that have actually gone through the whole state law enforcement process to this point. Of those, I think less than a quarter have had anything to do with interference of any kind, not just to a licensed radio station, but also to possibly one air traffic control frequency at an airport somewhere or something like that. So even though the hype is being made that these pirates can cause danger and they can run technically bad systems, by and large, they are still not.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening actually to WFMU, which is a non-commercial station out of Jersey City, New Jersey. Runs a free-form music format, very community radio-like. And the station manager actually did a report on air and talked about that they're actually having difficulty with some pirates on the edge of their signal.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a terrifically strong signal because almost no non-commercial stations in New Jersey have strong signals by virtue of being sandwiched between New York and Philadelphia. But having problems in Brooklyn and in upstate, actually, with some pirates on their signal. And he mentioned that he didn't think the FCC was doing a darn thing about it.
No.
Which I think is an interesting way to look at it. In a lot of ways, he'd probably be better off trying to find a pirate himself and trying to say, hey, dude, why don't you relocate to a new frequency rather than getting the FCC involved. But with regard to the changing the landscape, I wonder, I mean, it seems to me there could be two real outcomes for the civil disobedience pirate. Growing commercial pirate side. One would be it almost gives the FCC more targets and easier targets to hit,
mm-hmm,
with their relatively limited enforcement funds and time. It almost could give them cover.
Right.
Since it seems as though the civil disobedience pirates, there's some who definitely run totally above ground operations as an open challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those who run much more stealthily, who are actively trying not to get caught.
And that's the growing number of politically motivated, right, pirates in the United States. They tend to be smaller, either individual or very small collective groups that run hit-and-run operations on specific nights, or they do specific events. We're not seeing as many of the Free Radio Berkeleys, Berkeley Liberation Radio, and Freak Radio Santa Cruz types that are running 24/7 in your face.
But given this enforcement pattern, it would seem to me that in many ways this would be an opportunity for them, because on the one hand, the FCC has many more targets to go after who are running 24/7 or running frequently enough to be easily gotten just by going out on it one day a month, and because they could use the data of knowing when the FCC is going out to their best advantage to plan their broadcast. Seems to me that could be one real outcome, is that it could actually provide cover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, it's a lot like, you know, sending out your infantry to,
yeah,
get shot at. You could see that as the commercial pirates, while the politically motivated ones, the civil disobedience crowd, could really kind of hide a lot better because, you know, there's so much else distracting them. But it also seems to me there's a flip side in which if the problem gets bad enough with the commercial pirates, it could cause a change in priority at the FCC in response to that, such that real sweeps would happen.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that because the FCC has already taken steps to beef up its field enforcement authority and its presence. For example, in the last budget cycle, they got pretty much a completely newly revamped field vehicle fleet. They've upgraded their mobile direction finding capabilities, computerized everything to hell and back, and they also increased the travel budget. So ostensibly, field agents can spend more time on the road now actually doing things like pirate hunting. Is that reflected in the amount of data that we're seeing? I'm not exactly quite sure, because it seems like there's been an increase in field activity across the board, not just looking at things like pirates. They're doing a lot more things like busting people for public file violations. That's been something the FCC's really been on a tear with license stations in the last few months, especially over the fall. So there are ways that the FCC has already attempted to increase its field presence. The problem is that in an agency of 3,000, less than 10% of the personnel are actually actively involved in going out into the field and being the long arm of the law. And the relative age of those people is increasing. In the last couple of years, for example, I think through 2008 or 2009, the FCC is projected to lose half of its field enforcement staff to retirement.
Wow.
So even if they get the money to drive their newfangled vehicles to bus people, will they actually have the people behind the wheel to do it?
Because those people have to have an engineering background
of
some sort.
And they have to be trained. They actually go through a nominal law enforcement course.
This is not simple stuff.
No,
we may occasionally tease the FCC enforcement agents.
Clipboards and things.
But yes. it is actually something that requires a high degree of training and technical competency. And then probably a lot of people aren't getting. I mean, it's just like it's more and more difficult to find radio engineers.
Right.
Now, broadcast radio engineers.
I think one of the scariest things that could possibly happen, and maybe the only way that the FCC could go on something like a nationwide sweep, to a level that we've never seen before, is if there was some sort of concrete evidence tying the operation of a pirate station into some sort of major disaster.
Right.
If that could possibly happen, that would be, you know, kind of the hook, the Reichstag fire, as it were, that would then allow the agency to go gangbusters. The problem is that the agency is getting hit from so many different sides, and a lot of those sides tend to be public interest sides. They're in the middle of, for example, a media ownership rules review. They're looking at things like the merger of AT&T and Bell South, and there's a lot of pissed off citizens that have discovered that the FCC exists, and they're getting hit with a lot of public input. And when they go around the country to do all these hearings, you know, like the future of media town meetings. Adelstein and Copps were just in Seattle yesterday doing their thing. They're going to be in Nashville, Tennessee as a full body on December 11th having an official media ownership hearing. They're hearing from pirates. People are coming out, pirates are coming out and getting in their face and saying, this is what we're doing. We're breaking your laws, and that's because your laws are bad and need to be revamped. And until you do that, we're going to keep doing it. And so even if the FCC was somehow to get an influx of money and manpower, I think that there is really no way that they can stop this from happening. And that's good news, because even though, for example, a lot of folks in the low power FM community decided to kind of do away with micro radio, they've said, you know, the people that are still engaged say that there's still space to improve access to the airwaves, and putting pirate stations on the air is the best way to demonstrate that potential.
Very much so. With that, we have to end it here at the end of the Media Geek program. John, thank you.
Thank you.
DIYmedia.net. Lots of information about Pi Radio and other Spectrum broadcast issues, as well as your archive of truthful translations. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.